Hi, I'm Michael, and this is Beyond the Screenplay. Today, we are talking about Terminator 2 Judgment Day, the 1991 film directed by James Cameron, written by James Cameron and William Wisher. I'm joined by the Lessons from the Screenplay team, writer Tricia Aran.
Hello, everyone.
Writer Brian Bittner. And editor Alex Calleros.
Hello.
So we're talking about Terminator 2, but I literally just saw the first Terminator. Last night.
For the first time ever?
Yeah.
I don't know why this continues to shock me.
It really shouldn't. It's from the 80s, too. Like, you should be prepared for
this. It's from the 80s. T2 was in the 90s, so it passed the Michael test. But
so barely. Like, the early 90s were basically the 80s.
There was something just better about them. I don't know. But,
oh, my God.
So it was really interesting seeing it that way. And I had heard so much about the original Terminator, as you do. And mostly I'd heard about it via like old TV shows I would watch that were about like visual effects and like this revolutionary thing, the Terminator. So I felt like I'd seen most of it, but I also was kind of bracing myself for it not being very good and not holding up very well. So that's why I was trying to avoid it for a long time. And we'll get to that later.
Oh,
but
boy.
It's such an, just an interesting relationship, like looking at, you know, these movies and Alien and Aliens as sequels, the things that you can spot that are the same and are influenced by the other things, but how radically different they are. And I think the thing I appreciated the most, now having seen the original Terminator start to finish, was how different Sarah Connor is in Terminator 2.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's 7 years later. So that is, I think, a big part of it. Like, these days they would crowd the sequel, as soon as they possibly could, right in afterward. And this one, they were like, 7 years later, and the technology obviously changed a lot.
Oh my God, the visual effects are night and day. It's crazy.
I know. Yeah. I mean, I feel like I want to throw it over to Brian to tell us a little bit more about the video.
Terminator 2 is interesting because it was the second half of James Cameron's original story. You know, so he was basically like, there's this thing happens, da da da, and then this other guy shows up later and blah, blah, blah. And then once he realized for budgetary reasons to just make the Terminator what it was, then when he moved on to a sequel, he said, now we can take this, what maybe would have been 30 minutes of his original idea, and turn it into a 2.5 hour, you know, blockbuster. And then I think it was Linda Hamilton who actually said, like, I think that we should actually look at how Sarah Connor would feel.
I love that.
Right. Yeah. And I think that that's something you don't get a lot in movies and shows and stuff, is what is the real actual result of someone going through whatever they go through. I mean, same with Aliens, you know, it's like, it's not just like, well, here we go again. It's like, you don't understand what I had to go through. And especially Sarah Connor, like, what I know that of course nobody in the world is ever going to believe. And then you throw her son into the mix, and there's just such an interesting series of things going on in her brain, you know. And then it's like, they did a great job, I think, of just saying, like, let's kind of meditate on this character who has basically knows the future and is you know, the Cassandra complex, basically, you know, and can't stop it, and then, you know, comes face to face with the thing that, you know, tried to kill her all those years ago. And just like, what a scene, you know, when she first sees him.
I was gonna say, that scene has such a different meaning if you see the movies out of order,
because
if you see T2 first, there's so much less in that moment.
Right.
But when you see the first Terminator, you realize the whole time she's been waiting for, like, Arnold basically to come back. And that is what she's most afraid of. And that moment has so much weight in T2. It's amazing. And then
they save it for so late in the movie too.
Yes.
Really smart.
It's almost like saving the T-Rex in Jurassic Park.
Yeah. You know,
it's like waiting for that big reveal. And then it just goes crazy.
Well, it's also interesting because by that point, we kind of trust him, right? Because we have that whole standoff in the hallway where we see him, and then, like, obviously that an awesome truck motorcycle chase, and we trust him at that point. And it was like, I actually was rewatching it, and I was like, she still doesn't know. She still doesn't know.
Mm-hmm.
It is so late. I mean, I would be curious to even know the minute count, but I assume it's somewhere around like minute 40.
Somewhere like that.
Yeah.
Because I think it's minute 30 where you as the audience learn which guy is which in terms of what side they're on.
Right.
Because as we were saying, it's impossible to watch Alien without knowing that Sigourney Weaver is going to be the survivor. So we can't know what the experience was to just watch that movie fresh. In the same way, it's like, you don't watch Terminator 2 without knowing that Arnold's the good guy in the movie. But if you think about, you see the Terminator in 84 and then you see T2, there's 30 minutes of this guy showed up. He's the bad guy from the first movie. This other guy showed up. He's in a cop uniform. You know, they're both like hurting people to get clothes and, you know, motorcycles and whatever. And then it's not until that moment where John Connor is running between the two, and then he runs into the hall. Arnold pulls out the shotgun,
so drops some roses,
points it at him, right? Yeah, and points it at him, and then says, "Get down." And that's the moment where you realize, "Oh my gosh, he's actually protecting him." You know, and it's like, yeah,
so good.
Yeah,
it's such a good moment.
It was interesting watching the first Terminator, and they kind of do that in that movie also, where there's we know there's two people that have come back, and they're both kind of looking for Sarah Connor, and she spots Kyle Reese.
It's in the club in tech noir.
right, because Kyle's almost like framed like this stalker or something. He's just kind of like there, like looking at her, and she's like, "What is this guy?"
You know? Yeah, well, and yeah, it's that same moment of like Arnold comes in and Kyle Reese saves her from.
It is actually funny for how different those two movies are. There are a lot of similar beats.
Lot of callbacks. Well, a lot of lines that are in the first Terminator that we now think of as associated with T2, but they really are callbacks to the first movie. Or somebody else is saying it, you know.
It's for that reason so amazing that T2 manages to pull off that switch. Like, you would think the audience would be savvy to it, right? Where we're like, okay, we saw this, but we know now that Reese was a good guy and whatever. But managing to pull off that sort of sleight of hand where you really do think Arnold is the bad guy again, it works super well. Robert Patrick is the smaller, more clean cut sort of, they do that whole scene in the biker bar, which they trouble to set up that he's still a machine, right? And he still doesn't have human empathy, and he's not a good guy.
You're seeing Arnold's POV, but you're not seeing the T-1000.
Exactly. Yeah, right. Oh, yeah, exactly. But he's doesn't behave like a good guy in that biker bar, right?
Right.
And so they go to all that trouble to bait and switch you on Arnold. And even after they do that, you still are dying to know what Sarah Connor is going to do when she sees him.
Right.
And so they manage to draw that suspense all the way out until the midpoint of the movie, basically. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, and one of the cut scenes too is they shut down Arnold and to reset him, and then she wants to take his microchip and just smash it. She wants to destroy it. Even after he's like saved them and everything, there's this moment. Oh, because they sort of unlock him to be make him be able to learn from John.
Oh, I remember this from the extended cut.
Oh, I never saw that. Interesting.
I kind of want to like talk about extended cuts and stuff. We'll do that in a little bit.
Yeah.
It's just really interesting because that is her moment. And then John says, like, look, if I'm supposed to be this great leader, why don't you listen to my leadership for a second? And, you know, it's like, it's a really cool scene. Yeah.
I remember that.
10-year-old
right.
John Connor.
But especially because I feel like she, for as much as she's like, get away from that thing, it wants to kill us, like, she still kind of comes around pretty quickly. And that's what's nice about that scene in the extended cut is that even after they're like in a car together and everything's good and he's not trying to kill her, like, as soon as she has a chance, she's like, okay, I'm going to do this. And almost very matter of factly. And then John Connor does his, like, you know, squeaky voice, you know, no.
I mean, that is one thing about T2 that was pretty funny watching it again is John Connor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Edward like Furlong.
Like, Jurassic God Park bless. Velociraptor.
Yeah.
Is that what I think of every time?
They're just like, it's such like a 90s, like, such a 90s idea of what a cool kid is.
Oh, yeah. It's all that.
Or like an
style.
Edgy kid.
Yeah. We're like riding our little motorcycle with our like boom box on our shoulders and like hacking an ATM. Like, easy money. You know, all this stuff. It's
get
just,
wasted, dipwad or whatever. Just that. Like,
it's just so, it's like almost painfully early 90s.
You know what it really reminds me of actually is like the bad kid influence or like the opening sequence of Free Willy.
I don't even remember that.
You'll have to remind me of what the opening sequence of Free Willy is like.
Well, it's so the whole idea of Free Willy is that he's like a foster kid from the wrong side of the tracks, and they are like getting into trouble, and I don't think they have motorcycles, but they're basically like stealing stuff, whatever they can take, and blah de blah. And so I feel like it had to be that John Connor's character in this story directly influenced, because Free Willy, I want to say, is 92, maybe 93. It has to be that, where it's like, what if John Connor had to then save a whale? The premise of Free Willy.
I just want the Terminator to be a whale. I feel like an underwater Terminator film could be interesting.
Like, so it's covered in blubber instead of human exo.
Oh,
or
no!
Flesh.
Yeah. No.
And then the T-1000 is like a shark. And so it's the whale versus the shark.
James Cameron, call us.
This is a really amazing pitch, Michael.
I'm going to go.
I'm just saying there was an image of a bad kid
in the
early 90s.
Yeah.
And I actually feel like a lot of that, which carried over into other films, was constructed based on this sort of image of John Connor from 1991, where he has longer hair and he wears these baggy clothes and he, you know, again, you're stealing things and whatever. I think it's ultimately a really smart choice because, you know, we might scoff at it now as being ludicrous or whatever. Like, that's not what a bad, quote unquote, bad kid is.
It's become a cliche, but it, maybe
it has become
time,
a cliche, but yeah. Also, it makes him scrappy, resourceful, able to cope in a way, in the same way that the change wrought in Sarah Connor after the first movie makes her capable.
Right,
because
right.
That's the only way T2 works, is if both of them are somewhat capable. I think, I like it. When you see him speeding away from his foster family where he's just like, bye, and leaves.
Now
and
then, my mom, Todd. I'm going to listen to GNR drive around with Bobby Budnick from Salute Your Shorts.
I mean, we can see that he's like trouble, but we buy that he might be the leader of the human resistance if someone would just give him some guidance,
which is
the whole premise of this movie.
Yeah, I mean, it all makes sense from a story perspective.
Exactly.
It's just the funny early 90s like sheen on it all.
And
the delivery, you know.
And that was
moi, you looking at moi.
Moi is all hard.
Yeah.
And I feel like as like a little, because I was like 6 or 7 when it came out, I feel like I definitely adopted some of that. So joking around with friends, you know, when I'm really young, I think we talked like him sometimes because we saw these movies. And so it's
maybe
it's really sad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I still remember one of my favorite like early 90s thing is Go-Gurt,
early 90s, dude. That's like late. I'm going to go mid to late 90s. I'm going to go 96 on
Go-Gurt. Okay. Good stretch of the 90s.
Okay. Yeah. But this is the most like early 90s commercial or like general 90s commercial. But it's a kid eating yogurt with a spoon. And then this cool kid rides up on a scooter or something like that. He's got a helmet and he goes, yo, lose the spoon.
Yeah, I do remember that commercial.
Like, you know, those idiots eating yogurt with a spoon, like, screw them. We got Go-Gurt. You just one hand, you're done. And it's like, that was just like the era of that sort of like, let me show you what cool is, man.
Yeah, well, there was a weird 90s version of a cool kid. And T2 was like the epitome.
I think so.
And they were all, you know, 35-year-old screenwriters writing these,
exactly,
butt wad or whatever.
Like, I didn't know anybody who acted that way at all.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk about aliens briefly here because I feel like feel about his friend, the guy from Salute Your Shorts, who that's what I think of every time I see him, is that I'm watching Salute Your Shorts and I hate him in that also.
Mm. The ginger.
But yeah, I feel like the Space Marines would be like if the entire movie was starring the redheaded kid.
Right.
That's how that's.
Wow.
Anyway, that's
he grew up to be Hudson for me.
Right.
Very
but he's
maybe.
So well cast to be that character.
Right.
It's kind of ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And I do like, there is a moment where I really like his acting where he says to the T-1000, like, oh, I haven't seen him. And then he turns and there's just look on his face of like, oh, crap, you know? And it's like a really...
That actually is a genuinely good moment
in
the Galleria.
Yeah. Where Nikki Cox gives him directions.
Yeah.
I love how Brian knows all the trivia.
Yeah.
Well, because I love those, I call them pre-cameos, like Elijah Wood and Back to the Future 2, that. Like the cameos, because there's a reason they only had one line in the movie, because they were nobody yet, not because they were so busy they could only show up for an hour.
Right. I mean, I was going to say, in general, it was interesting thinking back to our aliens discussion. Michael, for you, the first Alien was such a masterpiece of a certain, you know, caliber, and Aliens felt almost maybe... I don't want to put words in your mouth, but kind of cheap in some ways compared to that. Or like because it was different, it was treating the subject matter with almost less reverence, maybe in your mind.
Mm.
It didn't, but it's like the opposite for me with the Terminator series, where T2 seems like so much more epic and reverent of this world and just so well thought out and so like masterfully executed. Where the Terminator, watching it again, it almost felt like an indie movie. The way it's constructed, it doesn't feel as much of a masterpiece to me as T2 does.
It's like, this is the proof of concept. Now that we've done this and we've set up this world, now we can move into the real movie.
It feels like, to me, Terminator 2 feels like the actual movie he wanted to make. And Terminator is like the low budget yeah, like you said, proof of concept.
Right. For sure. Yeah. Because I feel like...
I don't know if I all the way agree, but go ahead, Michael.
Well, I think because they have so many similar beats, like it is a very similar construction of the movie, but the first Terminator, like you were saying, it feels like a little sloppier, a little less refined, like, you know, I get the sense that it was the person making it was doing it knowing that it like would probably be good, but it didn't have the like confidence behind it. And the production of the original had hurdles that, you know, higher budget sequel didn't. But I think that's what was for me striking about it. It was seeing the original Terminator and seeing the like seeds of things that then felt like they were matured and executed like to perfection and with confidence in Terminator 2.
I mean, again, that's the technology. And to James Cameron's credit, part of the reason he cut a bunch of that stuff out of the Terminator because it was a part of his original concept was because he understood that the technology wasn't there yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's a sort of a common theme we see sometimes across different filmmakers where they're ambitious about something. I'm thinking about like Steven Spielberg and AI. Like, you know, he was developing AI with Stanley Kubrick and it was Kubrick that was like, we don't have the technology for this yet. And so they waited another decade. Mm-hmm. Just like put a movie on the shelf until the technology catches up to what you see, which, A, what a luxury and a dream to like right. be able to shelve a movie for a decade and still be able to come back and make it. But also respect, you know, you're not so shackled by the urgency of making a movie at a certain point, which again, you have to be a filmmaker of a certain caliber. But what confidence to wait to make something until you think that you can make it the way that you really want to and the way that it really deserves to be.
I mean, that's exactly what George Lucas said he was doing with The Phantom Menace.
That's what I was going to say.
He was waiting until
counterexample.
He could make the Gungans, you know, photorealistic.
Yeah.
Well, it is interesting, though, because I think technology does, it's watching The Terminator, again, thinking about all these things, like you're saying, Trista, the technology, CGI, Terminator 2, like, was such a landmark moment for that.
I mean, we do have it to thank for Jurassic Park.
Well, yeah. Even in the Jurassic Park making ofs,
exactly.
They always show like that shot with him walking out of the fire as like the first proof of concept of, oh, the CG thing can really work.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that when I was watching Terminator last night, that was one of the things that felt like it was holding the movie back, where it would just cut to like animatronic Terminator that like it felt like someone making a movie at the end of an era that like he wanted more, but it wasn't there. And so it was just trying to do the best he could, but it wasn't.
Like when it cuts to like stop motion.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Like you can tell the difference. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I will say you do get that in Alien also. Well,
there's that one shot where the alien's kind of just gliding across the floor.
Yeah. You have that shot, which is like dude in a suit looks like he wants a hug. And then you have when baby alien comes out of John Hurt with like his like silver teeth. And it's just like, okay, that's just like a thing on a string. But the one that's the most noticeable, and it's not bad, it's just noticeable, is, you know, Ripley like messing around with his plastic head, and then it cuts to Ian Holm.
Yeah.
Clearly beneath the grating or whatever. Yeah. It's,
Well, to make your argument also, at the end of Alien, when the alien's just like spinning outside the spaceship, I feel like that's the hardest for me. It just like looks so goofy, and it's just like we should not see that much of the alien. It's better when it's in shadow.
I will say, though, up until that point, all the models look amazing. Like, all the models of the spaceships floating around in space look so good.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and this is something we know, but just this idea that because we have new technology doesn't necessarily mean every single part of the old technology is ineffective and we should trash it.
Right. Well, I mean, Lord of the Rings, they had CG technology, but they built, you know, bigatures, they called them, you know, the big miniatures, and, you know, all the major cities in Helm's Deep and all these things were bigatures with CG added onto them. And that combination does have a different feeling than just an entirely CG image.
I will come back to that when we talk about what we're watching.
This idea is that we, the audience, but also the actors interact with things that are really there differently than with things that are not. And so if you can give them even a little bit of something that is actually there, and it might look like a really bad Arnold mask, but if you can give them a little bit of something that's actually there, you will get a different performance. You know, even the finest actors that we have, I mean, I wasn't going to bring up any of the Jurassic Worlds. I'm just saying they're not interacting with any real dinosaurs. Yeah. And they are not bad actors, but there is...
You can feel a difference for sure.
What's kind of interesting is that I think there's almost like different like kinds of acting that's required now.
Interesting.
Where like there isn't just like an actor, but like, you know, people that work in video games, they do a lot of motion capture where there isn't anything there really. And it's like they have to be able to generate these performances almost just like as if they're in a voiceover booth doing it by themselves, but it has to feel like they're actually interacting with people and in this environment, but it's not there.
Or The Last of Us, where like you put the actors in mocap and the two of them are just like having these very intimate scenes with each other in real life. And then that they just translate that to CG, basically. Which
They're interacting with each other, but they're just not in the actual space of the video game, obviously.
Right.
Yeah. They're on a blue dotted
thing. And that's like, what's his name? Andy Serkis, obviously, like who
that's
like a whole new kind of performance.
Exactly.
That he created basically. And you watch Benedict Cumberbatch doing the dragon from
those movies
that aren't the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
So frequent listeners to the show will know the team likes to tease me about a lot of things. And one of them is how I don't watch enough movies. A big part of that is a combination of not knowing what to watch and not wanting to gamble my time on something that I might not end up enjoying. Well, I'm excited to say that I may have found a solution to these problems. This episode of Beyond the Screenplay is brought to you by Mubi, a curated streaming service showing exceptional films from around the globe. Okay, so how does it work? Every day, Mubi premieres a new film. Whether it's a timeless classic, a cult favorite, or an acclaimed masterpiece, a movie you've been dying to see, or one you've never heard of before, there's always something new to discover. With Mubi, each and every film is hand-selected by an actual human, never an algorithm. It's like your own personal film festival, streaming anytime, anywhere. And my favorite part is that each film is only available for 30 days. This creates just the slightest bit of pressure to make sure you'll actually watch the film and not simply add it to your ever-increasing list of films to check out where it will soon be forgotten. You can try Mubi for free by going to Mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay. That's Mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay. If you were to just go to the website without using our link, you only get a 7-day free trial. But Beyond the Screenplay listeners get a whole month of great cinema for free. So again, head to Mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay or click on the link in our show notes to start your 30-day trial of Mubi. In doing so, you'll be helping support the show and get access to a service that I think you'll like. Thanks to Mubi for sponsoring Beyond the Screenplay.
But I will say the other thing that shares a chromosome with what you're talking about is the action itself, which is, to me, I think of The Fugitive, I think of Terminator 2, I think of The Dark Knight, like seeing an 18-wheeler like get flipped or go off a thing or something like that. To me, like seeing real footage of that, and of course you slow it down and you milk it, but...
I'm sorry, you didn't say Mad Max Fury Road, and I'm confused.
Well, Fury Road is like a masterclass in like just doing that every 2 seconds.
Yeah.
I'm talking about sort of like, Dark Knight isn't old, but like...
Yeah.
The classics, right, the lineage.
Of course, yeah.
We graduate from that to like, we talked about this in MCU, like, oh, now Iron Man and the Hulk are throwing buses at each other, but it's all CG and cartoony.
Right.
And you're like, even though the things that are happening are bigger... I'm not having a visceral response to it because I feel like I'm taken out of it. Whereas, oh no, that's a truck coming off a thing. And it can be something as simple as that. Or in Fugitive, it's actually Harrison Ford jumping away from a crashing train. Like they filmed that scene and it's like,
that scene
that's
in the
really
Fugitive
cool.
is amazing.
Yeah. And I think that that's where you get tricky. That's where it gets tricky when you go to CGI and that kind of thing is like, okay, you have to make it feel earned. You have to make me feel like I am feeling this thing, and Terminator 2 is obviously does that really well.
And the scene where Arnold lifts him off of his own like dirt bike or whatever and puts him on his own motorcycle and it runs over the dirt bike that he used to be on, it is very upsetting and thrilling. Like you are sitting at the edge of your seat even in 2019.
When the helicopter was like diving under the overpass and stuff, I was like, that is the most dangerous thing you could pop. Like that's insane that you guys did that.
And I can tell it's a real helicopter actually doing that.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Like, Michael's like just nervous. He's like, cut.
Well,
they already filmed it. It's fine.
It's interesting you mentioned The Dark Knight, because I think the reason The Dark Knight resonated with me so hard beyond the Joker, beyond Heath Ledger's amazing performance, was that it felt like it had recaptured that T2 action feeling, you know, right. Especially that car chase scene. It was like, I've been missing this. Where has this been? This is like solid, heavy, like crunchy, you know, intense action scene that doesn't feel safe. There's no safety with the CG and the kind of bounciness.
Right.
It's just like an amazing, like balls to the wall, cut out the music, just loud sound, let's just do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think T2 also just is still such a classic in my mind because every scene is that. Like, I don't think any of the action sequences are really subpar. You know, there's a lot of movies, there's like the one sequence that's like really stellar and then the rest are kind of average.
Right.
But everything, even down to Sarah Connor trying to escape from the
mental
institution.
Oh my gosh.
What an amazing sequence.
An amazing, maybe one of my favorite sequences in the whole movie.
Yeah.
Just because of her like jog.
Oh, it's a pretty
her jog is like, when she spins light-footed jog.
Baton jog.
Yes. The baton jog like shot is forever burned in my mind. That is like one of these shots. Yeah.
But even going back to, we're talking about like those big rigs and like all of that, the explosions and everything. The scene back at the end on the bridge where, you know, the T-1000 flips, like gets in, pulls the guy out of the big rig or whatever, and then like, you know, makes a U-turn and comes back to get them and then runs over that car. It's so good. Sorry, is that what we were talking about all along? I thought we were talking about the chase with the motorcycle at the beginning.
We're talking about it all.
I mean,
amazing. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I think there's something, I guess it's just like a human weird, Michael and I were talking about this, like what is it about like vehicles like loudly like crashing and breaking things that is so freaking satisfying.
That's kind of what I was thinking about the entire time watching Terminator 2 was like what is it about our monkey brains that's just like big things smash go boom, like I will like but that we're like picky about it too, that there's like no, we want to feel like it's got to be real, like we have a certain like
it's got to
range
be,
that we can accept our big boom.
It's got to be like adequately heavy feeling and like crunchy and loud.
Well,
and,
also like Terminator 2 is like also such a like blue collar industrial.
Yes, yes.
You know what I mean? It's like you've got your dive bar.
Both of the Terminators are.
Well, sure. Yeah. Like you've got your industrial factory and your dive bar and your motorcycles and your trucks and all this kind of stuff. And there is something visceral about that. Same with Alien, the sort of truckers in space aspect of just sort of this feeling of like, oh, this is real stuff. This is like the bar down the street. This is the guy that I saw walking, you know, whatever the other day. Like, it just feels like, oh, this is our world that we're seeing this fantasy happen in.
Well, that goes back to that James Cameron quote that you had, which was about the Sarah Connor being an every woman.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's where this movie is at its best. Not that she is in this movie, because obviously she's completely transformed from the first film. But in the first movie, the setting up of who Sarah Connor is, she's so normal, right? She's so relatable. She's living they have that whole scene in the diner where everyone is being terrible to her and that kid puts a scoop of ice cream in her pocket.
What was that? I was just like, what is this?
Like, I feel like if
a little
like,
too on the nose,
cool bad boy kid is like a 90s thing.
Right.
I feel like some of that stuff was like
harried waitress.
Like 80s thing.
Like mischief.
Like extreme mischief. Yeah. Like, I'm going to sacrifice my entire dessert just to put it in your apron or whatever.
Which
like,
no kid would ever do, realistically.
Extreme Mischief is the name of my metal band.
And her friend is so 80s, my God.
Oh, my God.
It's amazing.
But, this everydayness or this feeling of accessibility is really where these movies shine, because we are much more interested in seeing a movie about somebody like us that is being put into this extreme situation and they're coping. And obviously Reese is there and he's saving everything and trying to teach her how to do everything. But that is, it's relatable. Mm-hmm. It makes Sarah likable. You want to see her survive. I mean, all you need to do is hear her calling to her iguana to like come and jump on her shoulder. And you're just like, I love you. You should live. And then her boyfriend stands her up, which I love. It's random side plot they're like dressing up to go out. And she goes to a movie by herself. Uh-huh. You know, she's just like a working woman. Like, She's relatable. And then when we see the trans, it makes the transformation all that more effective. Again, just hail to that choice, because that is one of the strongest choices that you ever could have started with for T2.
I was trying to think of other sequels that do that much of a radical transformation, and nothing is like jumping to mind.
Mm-hmm.
Where like, it's a bold, it works.
It's a bold move, because usually the safe assumption is, well, if this first movie worked and was successful, then kind of do the same thing. And to be like, no, my very likable every woman normal female lead is now going to be kind of crazy and like really intense and like doing things that we actually aren't rooting for her to do at certain points in the movie. That's a very bold choice, but it makes so much sense for the story world. So like, thank God he did it.
Of course, the transformation or the 180 doesn't always work, because when you make John Connor the bad guy, you have Terminator Genesis.
Mm. Which I did not see.
Five.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes.
Because
we're
so
coming
one,
up on six.
Six is the next one's coming out.
But in as far as James Cameron's concerned, it's three. Which
okay, so yeah, I was
as
gonna,
far as I'm concerned.
I was gonna ask about that, because is it basically because Sarah Connor's still alive in it?
Yeah.
Which and she died in Terminator 3. Or
she was dead.
So basically we're just skipping over everything.
Yep.
So it's T2 and now it's Terminator Dark Fate.
Yep. It's like Inglourious Bastards logic. Just pretend that stuff never happened and it happened this way instead.
I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, this is sort of the first Terminator movie in 15 years. Math. 18 years? Longer. Oh no.
It's been a long time.
Anyway, this is the sort of the first one I'm interested in seeing.
Mm-hmm.
Me too.
Honestly, I mean, the minute I saw the trailer in theaters and the minute Linda Hamilton climbs out of that car with like, what does she have, a grenade launcher?
Yeah,
like, and I'm just like, yes. Like, I will go see that movie all day.
Yeah.
And I really haven't seen, I think I maybe saw three once. I definitely haven't seen four or five.
Mm.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, I remember seeing three with my friend who originally showed me Terminator, like who got me into Terminator 2. And it was one of the more awkward, like it was like, oh, this is like embarrassing.
Yeah,
like,
I've seen them all and the television show.
Right.
Yeah, the show is great with Lena Headey as Sarah Connor.
Which is such an interesting just random little piece of trivia that two Game of Thrones characters have played.
Right.
Like
Sarah
the
Connor.
Two
Sarah Connor.
The two queens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
But the show was great, except that season two ends on a cliffhanger and that's it, because then the show was canceled, because that's frustrating how TV works. But yeah, three was weird. Three was trying to sort of like take the comedy of two, and it made it too campy. So it's like Arnold goes into a dive bar, but it's a gay bar, and there's the
hashtag eye roll,
the Terminatrix or the TX,
but of this time it's a model.
But
not that I'm defending it, but watching Terminator 1 and then 2 again, like the robots chose Arnold to be their like archetype, their prototype.
Sure.
Like, why that decision? Why an Austrian man twice? Like,
he can do any voice.
Right.
But his default voice is with a strong accent.
Right.
Well, like, I think in Dark Fate, we're going to meet maybe the... Like Arnold plays a character, so I don't know how much.
Oh, he's gonna be like a human person,
right? Like in Alien versus Predator, Lance Henriksen plays the character that Bishop is modeled after.
Oh, cool!
And I wonder if they're doing like a similar thing here. I'm sure
I'm
it's
here
already
for
out
it.
There. Yeah,
mm.
But I will say Terminator Salvation I thought was pretty decent, just because it's kind of it took place during the war, and I think you look at like the opening battle sequence of T2, you're like, I want to see this movie. This is cool. And Terminator Salvation isn't great, but I think it did a good job of being like, let's actually live in this sort of dark territory for a little while. And then Genesis was just like a fun, stupid, bad movie. But you're like, well, okay, I watched it.
Yeah. I mean, just sort of going to what you're talking about, Brian, normally sometimes we talk about the weight of the past, but I think T2 works because of the weight of the future. Where we know that Sarah Connor, she has that vision at the beginning, and it's of the kids and the playground.
Yeah, it's brutal.
It's horrifying.
Dream.
When it goes to the full dream later, and it's just like, it draws it out. It's like, let's have the first blast and another blast now.
Yeah.
And now they're going to be like disintegrated, and now her skeleton's left.
Yeah.
It's gruesome. But we have to have that from a character standpoint. We have to have that motivator. And we, the audience, have to be visually reminded of what is at stake in order to really be on board with Sarah's journey. And so, like, as goofy slash upsetting, they're kind of both when you watch them now.
That's fair.
You know, as sort of whatever as they are, they're still in there for a very specific reason. And so, you know, we were talking in Aliens about how they cut a scene out of it that has to do with a character choice and how inexcusable we all find and found that at the time. I'm glad that didn't, I mean, you've seen the extended edition, so you probably know more than I do, but I'm glad that, like, a lot of that motivational sort of stuff for Sarah stayed in T2, because I really feel like you do need it.
Definitely, yeah.
And it's a weird thing watching that, because that moment basically motivates the plot forward.
Exactly.
And it feels like a little bit like cheating to me. Like, it's basically, she goes to sleep, she has a dream, and now the movie's about this. And I feel like if executed in any other way, like, I feel like that would have felt lame. But because it is, maybe because it is so drawn out, and it really is like we're going to experience her and be in this headspace, it has enough to catapult us into the next section where now she's going off by herself and they have to go chase after her, even though they just got her, but we're going to do it again because she has a new thing now. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's that weird thing where I was like, okay, yes, this works, but like, I feel like you got lucky a little bit. Like, you couldn't do this twice and have it be okay.
Mm. Well, speaking of the dream and just kind of the nuclear fear.
Nuclear.
You said nuclear.
Did I do it?
I think it's like the second time you've done it.
Oh, no.
Stop counting, Bri. Yikes.
Anyway, the threat from the atom bomb.
Yeah.
I think is really it was interesting watching it because it's not like that threat has gone away.
No.
It's 100% still here and maybe more dangerous than ever in our current global climate. But we just don't really think about it as much day to day. And now we have also climate change and all these other new global threats on top of it. And it was just interesting watching the movie again and being like, oh, that was never really solved. Like, this isn't just
definitely not
like this. You could still have a movie where this is like the main nightmare. We just haven't had it in like the media as much to like as our primary nightmare.
But, it's not in the consciousness as much.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Cold War.
Right.
We have a little bit of distance on the Cold War now where we're just kind of like, wasn't that crazy? Everyone almost blew each other up. Anyway, movies.
This is kind of a weird transition, but in thinking about that, when we were talking about, you know, Sarah Connor as an every woman earlier, I was trying to think, like, is that a thing we have anymore? Like, is there an every person? Like, I can't remember the last time I saw a movie that was really about, like, oh, he's just like an average Joe, like going about his life.
That like, wasn't like a romantic comedy.
Yeah. Or like, you know, the first 20 minutes of a superhero movie. Like,
well, that's what I was going to say, is that you have your Tony Starks and your Bruce Waynes, but then you have your Peter Parkers and your Bruce Banners, you know, where it's like, oh, I'm just like, I mean, Bruce Banner's like a really smart guy, but, you know, your sort of character who's just a person trying to go through life and then suddenly is a superhero. But even like MCU recently, it is a little more like Doctor Strange, like this cool rich guy, you know, and it's like where their sort of character arc is going from like powerful to I don't know to then back, as opposed to like a Peter Parker who goes from like totally ineffectual, like, you know, every boy to then becoming this superhero. But again, that's all superhero movies.
I feel like that's also just a sign of the times where we live in a time where culture is not one, you know, we're living in our own bubbles, our own kind of, we're kind of in a very multicultural, pluralistic, you know, kind of uncomfortably so moment, and we don't have a unified, oh, this is like what an average person is, you know, that doesn't exist anymore. I mean, it never really existed, but we kind of had a previous like, oh,
it
like
did in the movie,
they're only they're only white people and they look pretty and they look like this and like this is an average person.
Just Devil Wears Prada popped to mind, where like, oh, like even in her world she is kind of like the frumpy one, or like the one but
Anne Hathaway is so like fat and ugly,
right
the craziest but she's the craziest still lines of the movie where people call her fat,
right
everyone is just like, oh my god.
But she's still this driven, you know, beautiful New Yorker and stuff. So it's not Linda Hamilton working in a diner. It's, oh, well, I'm, you know, a journalist and blah, 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 and I'm going to do this stuff. So it's like sometimes, even the every person is still cool or still, you know, whereas, yeah, back in Terminator days, it just felt like, oh, we can just have this person be here.
Let's just go back to like one of these classic archetypal stories, right? Which I feel like the Terminator series lives into sort of that huge tradition that you have of like a hero's journey where you have an average person. There's this call to adventure and whatever. So a hobbit comes to mind, not the hobbit. A hobbit who then inherits a ring, say, right? That's the kind of thing that we respond to as sort of being the same kind of archetypal story. Obviously, that's fantasy, but it still is. That's in every person. Hobbit is in every person.
I think
the way that a waitress is.
The Hobbit, the book especially, is a great example.
Absolutely.
Because I was actually just talking about this today in my book club, which was not about The Hobbit. But it's like in that book, you spend this time with Bilbo and he just loves his home and he wants to sit by the fire and have a tea. And then this thing happens. And there are so many, every so many pages in the book, he just says, I just wish I was by my fire at home. And yeah, you're in Middle Earth, but you're just going, aw. Like this, like every man just wants to like be at home and enjoy a cup of tea by himself. You know, like it's not like I miss my kids or something. It's just.
Because even something like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, right? Mm-hmm. She is very average. But she is the person that takes the step. She runs away from home. She goes and meets that fortune teller and whatever. She is taking an action. There's action on her part. So there is still this sort of like, I don't want to say transcendent or divine, but like this sort of call to adventure from above in some ways when she gets sucked up by a tornado and dropped into Oz. But she is still taking some initiative in a way that Sarah Connor is absolutely not.
Terminator, it happens to her.
It happens to her. She gets snatched out of that super ordinary, super boring life that she honestly is not unhappy with.
She seemed fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, her job kind of sucked, but besides
she's got
that.
Yeah.
Her iguana.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I was just, it was interesting watching how in that sequence in the Terminator where it's like, this is her waitress job. And like, look at how average it is. And like, doesn't like working suck, but like, that's life.
Yeah.
Like it's doing that so hard that it just made me realize like, we don't have like that. Like you were saying, Alex, like, I think just culturally we're aware that we're all so like, there are different people and there are different kinds of people and that there isn't this just like, easy, quick reference
homogenous.
Of like, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're in a globalized culture now, you know, like, and movies travel and, you know, what it is to be one type of thing in one country is very different than another. And it's we don't have that unified kind of like bubble American 80s thing going on.
I like when I can identify like film language changing. And it was just an interesting idea of like, that was a piece of language that existed that does not exist like that anymore.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
What I'm curious to see, because there's kind of like, from the trailers in the new Terminator movie, there's somebody who needs to be protected, a new character.
Always.
Yeah, and I'm curious what her background is and what they're defining as this new every woman who like is the average person who needs to be protected in the new movie.
Yeah. We should all go see it and reconvene. And
can
maybe
we
do
please?
Like a Patreon episode. Oh,
mini episode?
Subscribe to us on Patreon, everybody. It's
no, but
be good.
Can we please like take a field trip? And
I
go
really want to see. Oh,
I'm like excited about it.
We should
it.
See it together. We've never
That's
done that before.
That's what I'm
before.
Saying. We should do that.
Field trip.
Yes, 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 yes. And then we will walk out of the theater and not speak at all.
Oh, just go straight to the microphone. Yeah.
We need to record the podcast that night.
In the car, like in the parking lot of the
Exactly. What were you going to say, Brian?
I wanted to go back to talking about like extended scenes and stuff like that, because I think it's a fascinating concept. Just to like add a couple extended scenes that were in Terminator 2, there's a scene with Michael Biehn as Kyle Reese in like a fever dream that Sarah's happening. And first of all, it doesn't feel earned because it's in the first 20 minutes of the movie. And Michael Biehn is still acting like it's 1984.
Oh,
you know, he's like, Sarah, you have to wake up. You have to do it. It's like, buddy, like, what's going on here? And it's just weird and doesn't feel earned. And that's one of those scenes where I'm like, yeah, I think this scene maybe makes this cut worse. Mm. But then you have the scene I talked about where she decides not to kill the Terminator. And then there's a scene where Miles Dyson's at home working and the kids want to go to Raging Waters and his wife's like, come on. And he said, no, I got to work on this thing. It's going to be great. It's going to blow them all away, blah, blah, blah.
Oh,
and then she's like, well, let's take a day off. And he says, okay. And the kids come in. They're so excited. And that scene is lovely because first of all, just more time with that family, you know,
they're lovely. Yeah.
But also just cause it really makes you more invested in them. And there's some other little moments. There's John Connor teaching the T-800 to smile.
I remember this. Yeah, that's a good
like,
scene. That's
it's good, but it's also, it's like, if you take Arnold too cartoony, then he's not a badass anymore.
Mm. Yeah.
So I think the scene is fine, but I see the argument for cutting it. I don't think it's, but point about mentioning all this is during Aliens, we talked about, I always want to watch the director's cut of a movie because I want to watch whatever they think the version is I should see. In Aliens, James Cameron says, this is the movie we want you to see. In Terminator 2, he said, this is another cut that I think is like nice to watch. And I think they're both good, but at your own discretion, which I think is nice. You know, he didn't say, here's some extended cut. You can do it if you want. He's like, these are two different cuts of the movie. They're both good. I like both of them, you know. And I think that sort of gives me like permission as a viewer to say, okay, I'll watch the theatrical, you know. But I'm just always curious when there are these cuts that you're not quite so sure about. Like there's Donnie Darko where the director's cut sort of just changes what the style of the movie is. There's like chapter headings and like all this kind of stuff. Alex, I think you said off mic one time like you prefer not to watch director's cuts.
It's not that I avoid them. It's that I notice that I tend to enjoy the theatrical cut more after watching them. Usually I find that the pacing of the theatrical cut makes a big enough difference that I find it to be a better overall film experience than most director extended cuts.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Midsommar we were talking about.
It was Midsommar, yeah.
Yeah.
Where like that's a movie where I felt like if we had gotten to the ending sooner, maybe I wouldn't have dropped out. Well, you know, of like being invested in the movie.
Midsommar is an interesting example because there's almost more, there's more continuity in the director's cut. There's more like, I'm actually tracking like the day night cycles of when they're there more in the director's cut. But in the original cut, it's almost more like a fever dream the whole time where you're like, how long have they been there? Like, what day is it? Like, what's happening? And that kind of makes it all just bleed together in a really wonderful way. And I actually missed that in the director's cut. It was a little too linear,
right?
And I think it plays better as more of a fever dream where you're just almost kind of confused.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
because I feel like I like the in your example that James Cameron says what each version is and what he thinks it should be, because I think you can misread director's cut as like this is what it was like supposed to be,
right?
And then like the studio came in and messed it up. But I think that's not always the case, and I think you said with Alien, Ridley Scott also kind of felt that way, where it's like there was an extended cut, but Alien is the movie we wanted you to see.
Yeah.
And I think just so much happens in the editing process.
Yes.
That I think it's knowing the context behind the cut is important because it might be less the actual true vision and more like a rough draft that they hadn't gotten to finish yet.
Yeah. I mean, the funny part is the editor in me usually wants a combination of the two cuts.
Mm.
Like usually there's like a few really important scenes from the director's cut that I wish were in the original theatrical cut, but then there's other scenes that I am very happy were cut.
That's how I feel about T2.
And it's just like, it's frustrating sometimes. I almost want to just take them and make a super cut of like my choosing. Like this would be my cut of the movie.
Right.
The combination of these things.
Speaking of Ridley Scott, Kingdom of Heaven. I saw that movie in the theater and it was 2.5 hours long maybe. And I walked out and I thought, I've never seen a movie where I walked out of the first viewing going, I want to see a director's cut of this movie. I want to see an extended cut because the pacing is so like, now we're here, now we're here, now this guy, you know.
I've only seen it once and I remember being pretty confused during it. I was like, what is this movie? It feels like this kind of grand epic, but yeah, the pacing was off,
right?
And I've heard the director's cut is way better.
The director's cut is 4 hours long.
Whoa.
But I will tell you, I love it. Like I
gotta watch it.
I put it on and was like,
well, so it's two movies.
Sure. Yeah. It's two movies worth of content, right. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, so is Return of the King extended. It's like 343 or something.
That's another one that I would like to do a combo and not the whole.
Yeah. Not the whole thing.
Yeah.
But no, I just thought it was really fascinating to see how much more I enjoyed the movie seeing the director's cut versus the theatrical. And obviously, mm-hmm. Lord of the Rings is the obvious example.
Right. Of course.
Most people are like, there is no theatrical cut anymore, you know? But then
I disagree with that. Because Peter Jackson even said that the theatrical cut is the cut. Like,
no.
He said that. He said that these are extended cuts to like give you more of the world and more. But he said the movies that we release theatrically are my vision. Those are the. He said that at some point.
Then why did he film 4 more hours of content?
Because why not? I don't know. I mean, that's he said that at one point. Maybe he changed his mind.
Okay.
But I feel like that's one of those examples where there's key scenes, especially in the Two Towers, that I think fill out Faramir's backstory.
Yeah.
That like make him actually like make sense and make him more of a real character.
Right, because he has this random line, a chance for Faramir, Captain of Gondor, to show his quality. Yeah. Makes no sense in the theatrical.
Right.
Then in the extended, you see the flashback scene with Denethor and Boromir, and he's like, oh, you want to go do this? A chance for Faramir, Captain of Gondor, to show his quality. I remember watching that with my friends the first time we saw the extended, and we're like, oh, that's who you are. That's like everything about your
character. Right, this is like the very important information to have to understand why you're doing anything. Anyway, but in those extended cuts, it's like it's almost perfect, and then they go to these weird extended like tree beard scenes or like now we're gonna sing a song from the books, and it's just like, I don't want these, just give me like the good stuff.
It's the creator dealing with constraints,
of course,
and
right,
I think, yeah, knowing the decisions behind all of it, because you know, in the Aliens commentary, Galen Hurd and James Cameron were talking about the reason they had to cut Aliens down, and it was like, well, multiplexes have this many screenings and it has to be under this time to get the maximum number of screenings per day, so we need to cut a reel's worth of
business. Yeah.
And so it's like, well, we cut this section, but sometimes that makes the movie better or shakes you out of what you thought the perfect version of the thing is. You
right.
discover things that work actually better, or you realize you don't need this, and I think it can just kind of run the gamut. I mean, I think about Arrested Development actually is an example of this, where they did the new season on Netflix, and I couldn't finish it. It was so bad and painful. And I think there's a lot of reasons.
But they had to do it that way for logistical reasons.
Right. And there was no constraints of it has to be 22 minutes to the to the minute.
Yeah.
Like it could be a 30 minute
episode.
Yeah,
but they just couldn't get any of the actors in the same room at the same
time. Right, that too. But I feel like it's that weird thing with constraints where if you don't have any, you can make a indulgent, boring thing. And if you have too many, then maybe you're cutting out the thing that makes your movie
make sense.
Right.
Well, the interesting thing is, I would imagine, I'm not going to actually predict the future because the minute I do, I'm going to be wrong. Look, there are different days for Judgment Day in every Terminator movie, so no one really knows. But it'll be interesting to see now that we have all of these distribution platforms where it really doesn't matter how long an episode of TV is, quote unquote. You know, I am not that old, but I came up at a time where I was still being taught in film school, okay, if you're writing a TV spec, and you're modeling it on whatever procedural, it has to be this exact number of pages, and it has to be, you have to have your five act, you know, so you have your commercial breaks and whatever. And same thing with screenwriting structure. It has to be this exact number of pages. And like, if you sent a spec script to even just your friend, not even a producer, and you know, it's 130 pages, they're like, it's too long. It's like, you didn't even read any of them. You glanced at the page count. And so now we're in a place where, because of the way distribution is working and production for that matter, the entire model has changed. That matters less and less and less. And so I will be so curious to see, you know, I wonder what, well, we're going to get a chance to see, but I was just saying, I wonder what Lord of the Rings would be if it were a miniseries now.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and I think, you know, one thing I've heard just kind of, what the industry is looking for now is really, it's not about any of these procedural formulas. It's really, can you capture an audience with the most compelling characters, with the most compelling conflict? So you must subscribe to this platform and you cannot stop watching the show. And if you can do that, then it doesn't matter if it's a, you know, limited series or a feature,
it doesn't.
Or, you know, it's, you're doing it in these very basic storytelling forms.
I said the word procedural to a group of young people the other day, and they had no idea what I was talking about. And then I said like the names of some of the longest running, most famous procedurals ever, like ER, stuff like that, you know, Law and Order. No idea.
Law and Order?
No, Gen Z is not about that. Yeah. They do not watch procedurals.
Yeah. Why would they? Yeah.
Hard agree.
PewDiePie's
there's no reason.
None
for-
of them.
God.
It is.
We made
it
how many episodes of that saying that name?
I think
we did our best.
It's interesting because I think there's also then going to be, I think that puts the responsibility on the creator then. Like when you're given ultimate freedom as a creator, you have to then self-discipline. And I think it just means you have to be really tuned into that and understand the importance of constraints and limitations. And sometimes you get to make exactly the movie you want, and it's The Phantom Menace. So, you know,
what a lesson that is.
Real quick, I want to talk about the sort of family aspect, which we really didn't get to with it's such a huge
we
part
of
T2.
We also didn't talk about Linda Hamilton's performance, which I really need to talk about.
All right.
Let's do it.
I think it's so interesting that you start the movie with Sarah Connor, who just wants to see her son. And then John Connor is like, oh, my mom's a total loser. You know, she's blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But then the moment where the Terminator says, oh, he's going to go kill her. You know, the T-1000 will try to, you know, reacquire her there. Then like, he's like, no, we got to go save her. I order you, you know, just like, which I love, such a heartbreaking scene. But then the moment they save Sarah, she just says to John, I didn't need your help. Like, you shouldn't have done it. You know, like,
it's
not
crushing.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like the facade versus the weak, you know, like that whole thing.
And she then scolds him for putting himself at risk for coming to save her.
Right. He's a soldier, not her son. You know?
Yeah.
What a brilliant writing choice.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah. That the conflict in that movie where, you know, and a lot of it is manifest when they're in that car, right? Where she's like, doesn't trust the T-800, and then she doesn't know her son, he doesn't know her, they're in the car with a machine. That odd triad makes for a lot of amazing conflict, even though a lot of those scenes end up being sort of expository or whatever. It works really well, and all of that contributes to what we were talking about, which is about the Dyson. It turns out to be a pretty big part of the plot, but when it starts and she leaves and she goes to kill Miles Dyson, it feels like a subplot.
Mm-hmm.
And then that whole like family theme, it's brilliant, actually. Yeah.
Also, Joe Morton as Miles Dyson, just his performance is like,
he's tremendous.
Is there another character you want to just hug more than
Miles
Dyson?
Oh, it's like it's dying and holding the thing. And it's it's such a good death.
So good.
When Hank from Breaking Bad shows up and
for like a shot.
I do feel like that's where James Cameron. Yeah, both in Aliens and in Terminator 2, just he really lets his actors go to these kind of extreme places that are almost, you know, I feel like slick Hollywood action movies, sometimes they don't want to embarrass themselves, or it's like it's gonna be the cool way to die or the cool way to do this thing. It's like, no, what does it actually look like to be like bleeding out to death and trying to hold something desperately with your last breath? You know, let's do that actually, not just like the cool, like slick, safe version.
Speaking of the every person like idea, Dyson very much also is an every person who just has fate sort of thrust upon him in that way, where Sarah Connor just barges into his house. He doesn't know what he's going to do. He's not planning to try to cause the apocalypse or anything like that. That's another really awesome example. It really recalls the original, where Terminators show up in her life and she's just for something in the future she doesn't have any control over and isn't trying to do or ruin or be a part of. And it claims her in the way that she comes in and claims Miles Dyson.
And she is the Terminator in that moment.
Ew!
Which is so good. I never really thought about it until this last viewing. But it's like she has become the Terminator.
Exactly. Yeah. She came there to kill him and then decides not to because she's human. But it works.
Kind of Minority Report-esque also.
Of course.
Punishing people for things
they haven't done yet.
Yeah.
What is the ethics of that?
Yeah.
Also, this is a time travel movie. I love time travel movies. Mm-hmm. And watching it again, it's like, wow, this did so many of the time travel things that I just have in my brain as what you do in time travel movies.
Similar to Aliens, though. You can't take your clothes if you're going to go time traveling.
Well, they can keep underwear on in Aliens.
That's true, but you're not going to be able to bring your clothes when you travel back in time. Isn't there a line to explain it?
They don't travel back in time in Aliens.
Yeah, there's no time travel.
They're just
in Aliens.
Freezing themselves.
Well, for 57 years. But no, I'm just saying in this movie, you can't take your clothes if you're going to go back in time. Right. Don't even think about it. Don't try.
You're saying the lack of clothes is the similarity.
Yeah, Kyle explains that to Sarah.
There's a line about it, isn't there?
He says you can't take anything.
Yeah.
Just your flesh and the things enclosed within your flesh.
Right.
While rewatching, I realized I should not try to question the logic of the Terminator. I thought it was later that they stopped making sense, but kind of just from the beginning. It's all a little wonky. Really quick, what you guys were talking about the heart that this movie has heart.
Yes.
And like, I watch these movies and there's part of me that's like, this is a dumb action movie. But then the rest of the movie happens and I'm like, no, this is a good movie. And like, I almost resent it for being good and being a dumb act. Like, it's undeniable.
Why do you resent it?
I think I'm
cynical, Michael.
I've become so, immediately judgy of dumb action movies, or I just like categorize them quickly because there's so many of them as being this, they do the things that they do. And these are Aliens and Terminator 2, whether I like them or not. I love Terminator 2, by the way.
More than Aliens. It's crazy.
Yes. Yeah, I think so. But they are doing this thing where they are telling a story while also having cool action stuff. And then I just look at things like Transformers that like tries to replicate some of that, where it's like, here's the action scenes and then like here's kind of a story in between them, but it's like clearly an afterthought. Sure. And I think that's what I continue to respect about the movies, even as I tried to judge them for being 80s movies and having all these problems. There's just something undeniable about their construction that I think is really, really impressive.
Well, that's a really good example of the difference between some of these summer blockbusters, these franchises where you go to them and they feel so soulless. They don't have that like that deep thematic core that these kind of James Cameron movies have, where you feel like the movie can do the most amazing balls to the wall action stuff, but it's never very far from like the core thematic, like heartfelt message and the heartfelt exploration.
It's almost like if you craft characters that have stakes, something to lose, a need, some might say, versus just a desire.
So bored, where's the explosions?
But right. there's as much care in the scenes between the characters as there is in the action.
They're not like the throwaway scenes you have to do to like hit this beat, to make sure that they learn something. It's like these are part of the movie as much as the action scenes.
Yeah. There's a lot of
even if you don't like the Terminator, the T2 relies on it. It absolutely relies on it. It doesn't make sense as a movie without it, because we have to have that relationship between Sarah and Kyle, and we have to have all of, imagine if there was no The Terminator. There's no sympathy for Sarah Connor at the beginning of this movie, where she's just like in a mental health facility, and that's a polite word for what that is.
Right.
Yeah. And they're just like restraining her, and none of that makes any sense. It has to be about the characters, which we say all the time, but you have to have that arc and you have to spend the time with them. Otherwise, we don't care about this family. And then you spend the whole movie helping the characters learn how to care for each other. That's the human part that you're talking about, where it's
absolutely.
Like, it's not cool learning how to care for each other, but it's not cynical, touching. It's not cynical.
Yeah, it's very earnest.
It is.
Well, speaking of all this, did you want to say anything about Linda Hamilton?
I just love her so much. first of all, her bangs. Can we talk about
that? That one scene where she's trying to like pretend to be like cured. Her bangs are so intense in that scene.
Oh my God. I just, everything about her haircut and her whole physicality in this movie, but it is her physicality that makes this movie work. Like, compare this to The Terminator.
Oh, it's really amazing, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How much she commits to this transformation.
Yeah. Tremendous. That opening scene where she's just doing pull-ups. Mm-hmm. She's, like, locked in her room.
When she turns for the first time.
Mm-hmm. With her bangs over her face.
Yeah.
The bangs.
Hey, Dr. Silberman, how's the knee?
So good.
Also, she's Earl Bowen so back good. As Dr. Silberman. Just like
I forgot he was in the first movie.
Yeah, no, I respect her so much. Her absolute commitment to this. Again, we go back to that transformation. We go back to that choice to make Sarah such a different character. But you have to have somebody like Linda Hamilton who is willing to really transform her actual body and really put herself actually through it to become a different character. that is the only reason this movie works, and she's phenomenal at all moments of it. I would actually just watch a movie of her trying to escape from that asylum. Like, it's incredibly compelling.
Hey, listeners, Brian here. Just wanted to take a quick moment and thank you for listening to Beyond the Screenplay. If you like the podcast, we'd really love for you to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us to grow the show and get more guest episodes with writers and directors. Also, if you want to help us to continue to make these episodes, you can become a patron on Patreon. For $2 a month, patrons get extra mini episodes and patron-exclusive Q&As. I know what you're thinking. For $2, I could buy 200 pieces of penny candy. But let me tell you from experience, that's too much candy. All right, back to the episode.
Good movies. There's a lot to learn from these movies. So why don't we go around and say what lessons we've learned from Terminator 2 that we're going to take away.
What a smooth transition.
Thank you, Brian.
It is actually right on the heels of what we were talking about, is those quiet moments. You know, I think sometimes I find when I watch an action movie, I have the opposite response as other people, where they're like, oh, action scene's done, people are talking, I can go to the bathroom. And I'm like, no, like the action scene didn't actually, it was cool, but it didn't necessarily further the plot. Like it was, oh, now these guys are going to fight for 5 minutes, or now this guy's going to chase this other guy for 5 minutes. Obviously, good action movies, the action does, you know, there change are stakes, and it does change something. But the scenes in between the action is, that's where the story happens. That's where the story actually happens. And I was thinking about this just during the moment where she's watching Arnold play with John, and she, you know, and she has her whole monologue, but it wasn't even like, forget the monologue itself, just the sort of aesthetic quality of that quiet moment, you know, just like they're here, they're at peace, she's just watching them, and I feel like I can take a breath. And that's kind of why what I talk about with something like the extended cut of Fellowship of the Ring, for instance, there are all these quiet character moments between the action, and I feel like that's where I come into the world, and that's where I fall in love with these characters, and that's where I get to know what this thing is. And yeah, it's funny because that moment ends with her deciding to go, you know, kill the nicest guy in the world. But like,
she doesn't.
Yeah.
I mean, she pulls the trigger. She shoots at him a lot.
What if she'd showed up and Miles Dyson was a total jerk? Yeah. Like he doesn't have a family. He's just like an a-hole. Right. Different movie.
But yeah. Just those action movies need more of those quiet, reflective moments, you know, and I think I really appreciate when they're done well.
Dynamics.
Indeed. I was gonna say dynamics. Yeah. Michael,
I mean, I think again that's kind of what I said in Aliens also, but I think talking about it even today, just the respect that I have, this almost like begrudging respect, it's I think what's so fascinating to me about it is, it's like, I think I haven't seen a James Cameron movie in a long time before we started doing these videos, this video, and like, I think it was one of those things where I knew they were good, but there was also Avatar lingering in my brain. And I was how am I going to feel going back to these? And I think there's just, there's such clear, like I was saying, there's passion about every moment of the movie. It's not just the action or this we're going to do this cool visual effect. Like, there's as much care put into the story and the characters and like every beat of it. And I think that's just such a cool example of what like a filmmaker should be, like excited about the movie from frame one to the final frame and all the parts that how they come together and give that experience to the audience, and that he has the self-discipline to be like, yes, I would love to have this reel in this movie, but actually when we cut it out, it moves faster, we don't need it. Like, it's just, it's, I think it's a cool mindset to aspire to if you're a filmmaker, and I am leaving these movies with a new appreciation for that.
Yeah, finding that balance is really like a, like such a precious piece of unobtainium.
I saw it on his face. I was like, he's gonna say something stupid. It's right in there.
You got me. You got me.
You can always assume I'm going to say something stupid.
Alex.
Okay, we're just a hot potato.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, really, it was just, once again, watching the first Terminator movie and then thinking about T2, the causality between the two movies is so smooth. You know, there's some sequels where they kind of, it's almost like, you know, backwriting or kind of making up like a new backstory to kind of fill in the new things they want to do in the sequel that didn't really make sense in the first movie. But this movie, like, I mean, these two movies, it's a kind of just one big story. There's not really a whole lot of extra stuff added in T2 that wasn't in Terminator 1. You know, that it set up everything for T2 and even literally like left the hand in the factory to be discovered. And so I found the causality and the fact they didn't have to really do a whole lot of like new world building in T2 to be really impressive. Yeah. It's like, oh, it was all there to start with. He really did have this bigger story in mind.
And he talked about that when approaching Aliens, which is where he looked at the first movie and he was like, what are some of the unanswered questions we might have that, again, might be a direct result or, you know, lead to this sequel pretty like chartably. It works well.
I remember being very impressed by how believable Aliens felt as a sequel for those reasons also.
But it's sort of the opposite of what Alex is saying, which is like, in a way that's fine, which is Aliens is taking Alien and saying there's not a lot here, how do we sort of like back retroactively
using the existing material,
of course. But then it, like the way the Terminator is sets up this whole world, this whole story, the T2 says, okay, we already have this story built, now we can play with it.
They don't say like, oh, Kyle Reese was lying about the future, it actually is a different future. It's like, no, it was all accurate in T1, and we're just building on that.
Yeah.
I feel like it's seamless in both movies.
Agreed.
Yeah.
I'm gonna go out on a limb here a little bit, which is that I know that his performance has been panned. I am not here to defend Edward Furlong's performance, although he was 14 years old. So listen, it's hard to be 14 and it's a difficult role to play. But I like the choice of giving that character so much agency. I feel like it was a real risk. You could have made John Connor any age. Right. You could have made him a lot younger. You could have made him significantly older because you have an actress like Linda Hamilton, again, incredibly versatile and amazing. And that change that has been wrought in her could have existed at different stages. Right. You could have set the first movie 4 years later or 24 years later. But to take this risk of putting it right in the middle and casting a young actor to play a young John Connor is risky. Some might argue it didn't pay off, but I like it. I think it's a risky choice. I also am just here for roles for young actors.
Sure.
And especially in action movies, like I think that the role itself is written as like believable. He's scrappy. He's tough. He's a kid from the streets. He's not here to, he doesn't need to be babied or coddled. Of course, we see the relationship develop between him and Sarah, but I like it. It's an interesting choice. And this movie would have been a lot less interesting with a much older or a much younger John Connor.
It's kind of an interesting like meta effect because I'm thinking about his performance and as I was watching, I was like, but I'm like rolling my eyes because I'm like, ugh, this kid, he's a kid. He doesn't know. He's like,
we lived in Nicaragua and places like that.
But like,
you're undercutting my lesson, Brian.
These are my favorite Brian impressions yet.
But I think his performance isn't great because he's a kid.
Right.
So I feel like ultimately it's still
successful in a way.
Right.
Yeah.
It's still a kid. We're almost like, because I'm thinking about Dakota Fanning in War of the Worlds, and I'm like, she was
never a child.
Right, exactly. Yeah. She's more together than anybody else. Yeah. I'm worried about her the least.
Yeah.
Right. Everyone.
Yeah.
So
it's something I'd mentioned about Daniel Radcliffe in the first Harry Potter and Mark Hamill in the first Star Wars.
Vulnerability.
It's like sort of the real human beings kind of naivete carries over into the character.
Yeah.
Agree. And it comes across, so all of his toughness then comes across as being this veneer or this bravado, which is what you want, because of course it is put on John Connor's part. He's trying to act tough because he's deeply wounded by the fact that he has lost his mother and all this stuff. And so in a way, again, I like the role, you know, and the performance I think works to an extent. And I just appreciate that choice. It was a really good, smart choice, I think, ultimately, even if you come away from it doing impressions like Brian does that are
amazing.
Shade throwing at best.
That makes it quotable. That's what's fun.
Sure, yeah.
There's always love in Brian's imitations.
He is one of the most quotable characters in this movie.
I walk away from Jurassic Park going, Dotson, we got Dotson. Nobody cares.
Cool. What have we been watching recently? Let's go around. Who wants to start? Trisha, I'm looking at you.
Sure. I don't know though. Last night, I have a few different things to say. So, like, do you really want to start with me? But I went and saw Ad Astra last night at the Vista Theater. You're welcome, Brian. as though you...
I have been there more recently than you. I was there this morning.
Oh, wow. You have been. It's a wonderful theater, but also it was just a really great experience going to see Ad Astra there. I'm curious to hear Alex's thoughts about it because I know he's seen it. I will say it is a gorgeous, gorgeous movie. I don't know if I've ever seen a movie that's so gorgeous and so overwrought. It crosses a point. It starts off so compelling to me. It starts off so compelling. It takes a turn where it becomes sort of overly weighty, in my opinion. And
I would agree.
Yeah. There, I would never myself have laughed out loud in that theater, but people were. Yeah. Yes. And so, and that once you have people laughing in your theater, which this movie is, there is not one laugh moment in it. It is not designed to be laughed at.
It is melancholy.
It is a lot. It is not designed to be laughed at. And so the minute that somebody breaks, anybody in your theater breaks, it just kind of destroys the spell. Yeah,
that's
you've
too
lost
bad.
It all.
Because, you know, I sat at ArcLight and there was no laughter. And even when I was kind of rolling my eyes sometimes, it did help me stay in it. Because you're right. When there's a group experience and somebody kind of like breaks the spell of the movie, even rightfully, it does kind of like ruin the rest of the experience. You can't really put that aside after that point.
But here's the thing I will say about it. I think it is almost to the movie's detriment that it's being marketed as an action movie, because it is definitely not an action movie. It is this contemplative drama. And so if you're in the mood for a contemplative drama, then go see Ad Astra. It's gorgeous. Brad Pitt's amazing. Like, go see it. But if you're not in the mood for a contemplative drama and you want to see an action movie, Ad Astra is not your movie.
Right. Well, it's I'll say a few things about it really quick, if you don't mind.
Yes, go. No, please.
So it's such a mixed bag of a movie because there actually are some really well-done action scenes. There's like a moon.
There's a
moon car chase that is like amazing.
Moon Pirates. I want that movie. I want it.
But it's in the same movie that's like Terrence Malick, Brad Pitt voiceover, like looking sad all the time.
It's so like a weird sequel to Tree of Life in a way.
But with action
scenes in it.
Anyway, it's a very interesting movie that I would recommend a theater experience of it just for the gorgeous space visuals if you're into that, because as I am. And I kind of just want to like have it like on Netflix or something so I can like watch pieces of it.
Yeah.
Because as a whole, it didn't hold together for me, but there were a lot of transcendent moments that are like, oh, wow, in a more cohesive movie, this could be one of my favorite movies. But the tone and it was, it's a tough one.
Brian, what have you been watching?
So I unfortunately haven't had time to watch all of it yet, but I started watching The Dark Crystal, Age of Resistance on Netflix.
Nice.
And it just makes me so happy. It feels like the original. You have these celebrity voices, but they don't sound like celebrity voices. So it's not the sort of
nice
animated movies these days where it's like, oh, yeah, that's such and such, you know. And, you know, we were talking about like the bigatures from Lord of the Rings and stuff. It's just that combination of practical with the occasional CG to sort of pepper in some nice effects and everything. But it just feels magical. I think that one thing that's really weird is, take a movie like Terminator 2 and you watch it and it's shot with 90s cameras and it's shot, you know, and it looks like a 90s movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be weird seeing Dark Fate looks like a 2019 movie. And it's like, that's such a strange thing when you sequelize a movie several years later, unless you do Blade Runner 2049, where you're like, let's completely like go all in on the fact that it's 2018, 17. But that's the cool thing about something like Dark Crystal, because it's all puppets and, you know, all this kind of stuff. You can basically make it look like it came out a week after the original movie, you know? And I think that that's something that you can't do with many things. And it just makes it feel that much more special.
Yeah.
Nice.
My movie is also a Netflix movie, and I feel like very similar to the Malick thing. I watched the Between Two Ferns movie on Netflix, and it's a masterpiece.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what else to say about it. I feel like if you...
I've also watched it, and I agree, it's a masterpiece.
Right? I feel like if you sit down and you're like, they made a Between Two Ferns movie on Netflix, I want to watch that. and you want, if that's what you want, you will be very happy.
Right.
Yeah.
If you want to watch the dumbness of a Between Two Ferns for an hour and a half.
Yes.
That's it.
Yeah. And it was pure joy for me.
Yeah.
I wanted a bit more John Hamm. That's my one
Don't
criticism.
We all?
Well, the weird thing is that he has done a Between Two Ferns. So it was weird that they didn't acknowledge in the movie, like, right. I've already done your show, but I'll do it again.
And yeah. what the most fascinating kind of like storytelling gymnastics was like the first 20 minutes when they were trying to build up this world and explain the world of Zach Galifianakis having this show that's Between Two Ferns that's in the same, like, and explaining why his weird side, you know, he has this show in Minneapolis or whatever. It's like some public access TV, but somehow he's getting these celebrities.
Right.
The way they like found a way to like explain it in like a dumb way, but a way that makes you be like, all right, cool, let's go with it. It was, I'm not gonna say impressive, but it was fun to watch.
Mm. That was a really complicated thing.
That was a lot going on.
Yeah.
It's a complicated movie, guys.
It is.
If you've seen,
it's not for the simple-minded.
If you've seen any of the Funny or Die movies, like iSteve, the first Steve Jobs movie with Justin Long as Steve Jobs and somebody else as Justin Long because Mac commercial.
Sure.
And The Art of the Deal with Johnny Depp as Donald Trump, which is so many things
Yikes.
About just that pitch. But it just has the like purposeful dumbness of a funny guy.
Right.
Like, they're not trying to be dumb funny. They're just trying to be dumb.
Yeah. Alex.
Also Netflix. I watched American Factory, which is a Netflix original documentary that was brought to Netflix by the Obamas through their new production company deal with Netflix. I think it's called Higher Ground. And I think they picked it up at Sundance. And it was a remarkable documentary. I would highly recommend it. I think it's one of the better made modern documentaries I've seen. Really beautifully shot, totally observational. They have no real like editorial spin on what they're observing. Mm. And the log line basically is in an Ohio town where like the big GM plant closed down. Everybody lost their job. A Chinese company comes and opens a Chinese plant there. And it's this amazing observational documentary about what happens when there's a Chinese organization employing Americans and Chinese workers shipped over from China together in a plant, and like what happens.
That sounds fascinating.
Some parts of it go over to China, and it's so relevant and so fascinating about what our world is right now. And it's actually just a very, I haven't seen a lot of documentaries lately that just commit so hard to just a pure observational style and do it with such like grace and class and like objectivity. It's really, really well done.
Awesome. Cool. All right. Well, this has been our conversation about Terminator 2. We'd love to hear from you. So hit us up on Twitter. My Twitter is at Michael Tucker LA.
At Brian Bittner.
At Trisha Jean A.
At Alex_Calleros.
And then there's the Twitter for the show at BT Screenplay. Thank you all for listening, and we will see you in the next episode.
Adios. Bye.
Bye, everybody.